Anyway, right now, this panel, you heard some of the things about standards by William Miller just before lunch. So we continue that, a segue into the current session. And Sub from CMU is going to moderate this particular panel. Sub, you can go ahead. The floor is all yours.
Thanks, Ram. Yesterday and today, we've been talking about interlinking of devices, people, physical environment, and all of these things pose challenges and interoperability. But maybe yesterday you guys talked about it, but nobody talked about compositionality of these systems and whether those systems and combined together will work. And I think that is an issue that is also part of how we link devices together and operate together. So we still see that interoperability is a problem everywhere. And even though many people have advocated the use of ontologies, like we heard earlier, Joe talked about a lightweight ontology being useful. So we still have figuring out what kinds and forms of ontology will be useful in a variety of contexts. So we have a set of people today, people who have worked with standards in a variety of ways. What I'm going to do is introduce one by one, and the first person who's going to talk to us today is Elaine Newton, Dr. Elaine Newton. She's a deputy standards liaison for Information Technology Lab and the National Institute of Standards and PICNIST and the ITL programs. She has led a lot of standards liaison coordination and support of ITL, and she also worked with NIST and the State Department and others in coordinating standards efforts. I'll stop there.
Good afternoon. I'm going to give a very general talk about standards organizations and general standard strategies. Some of it might sound very obvious. Some of it might sound like something that's new to you. So feel free to ask questions, but we'll save some time for the broader discussion at the end, too. So in this talk, I'm going to use the term standards organization. And I'm going to use that to mean, instead of getting to the semantics of standards developing organizations, standards setting organization, I'm going to use that broadly to talk about organizations, whether they are accredited by a national standards accreditation body like ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, or any of the number of international standards organizations like ISO or IEC, which are private sector international organizations. OASIS and IETF are examples of consortia that we consider international organizations. Not every country does. I'll leave that as a footnote there. And they're also international treaty-based organizations like ITU and ICAO. As Sub said, I work for NIST, and I will just briefly say, as you know, we are an agency that has our mission to advance standards testing and measurement. We're not a standards organization. There is one exception to that. But in general, as a general rule, we are not like an ANSI-accredited standards organization. Sometimes there's that misunderstanding. The big picture, I'm guessing this group understands that standards are important in the sense of they are better for economic growth than, say, regulation or even patents and licenses. They show that they have more flexibility to allow for innovation. Companies that get in the development of standards are more able to get a head start or assess risks before they deploy technology or develop technology. So given all of that good stuff, the U.S. government policy is to favor voluntary consensus standards, and in particular international standards, in our procurement activities and our regulatory activities, except where it's impractical. And our laboratory, ITL, the Information Technology Laboratory, has a strategy of trying to get our staff out to these standards organizations as opposed to developing standards in-house. We do have the ability to develop federal information processing standards, FIPS, but we develop them on an exception basis. Most of our work in standards is going out to the private sector-led ecosystem and participating just like companies would or other stakeholders would join a committee. We have about 80 of our staff in standards activities, about 100 different standards activities. in just our lab. Another bit about standards organizations. They mostly develop standards through a consensus process. They all do things a little bit differently, but they're characterized by some features such as open membership, transparency of their process and how they make decisions. The drafts can be transparent to just the membership or the public. That can vary, but there is the aspect of transparency in the processes of standards organizations in some way, usually. There's the aspect of balance of users, consumers, producers, and other stakeholders, and hopefully there's some form of due process in the process and allow for appeals when decisions have been made that the membership wants to say, hey, that wasn't really representative of consensus. And we don't discriminate against organizations that find consensus by voting, by humming, by any number of ways of going about finding out if the group has decided that this document or a decision within a document is representative of the committee at large. We also don't discriminate against standards organizations if they charge for a reasonable fee for their products or if it's free. This is something that sometimes comes up because some groups want to favor organizations where they don't charge for their standards. We don't have, we are agnostic about that. So now that we talked about standards organizations, let's talk about the different stages of standardization and maturity model. In a technical area that's new, you typically won't have standards, and you're at the first stage. I point this out because you start off with not having a standard to getting some project under development and approving a standard, but it doesn't stop there. What's important is that you get passing conformity assessment tools and get into building products and services to standards. And eventually, hopefully, you have market acceptance. That's a sign of a very mature standard or standards area. Why is that important? I point this out because having a standard itself is not the end goal. The end goal is that you fill the gap that companies have some driver to build to that standard. And that driver could come in any number of forms. It could be because there's a large acquisition that's going to require that standard. It could be because that companies want to avoid regulation. They see regulation coming down if they don't get organized and try to figure out a way to deal with the technical area in standards. The point I'm trying to drive here is that these are voluntary standards that we're talking about. In order to see companies actually implement them and see them be successful, there needs to be a driver in order for them to pick up the standard and use it as opposed to doing their own proprietary solutions. Emphasize that point enough. Okay, so let me give you examples of standards organizations in two IT areas. What you're going to see is a little bit of an eye chart. First, for cybersecurity. Let me walk you through this. Above the dotted line, we have an example in cybersecurity of a variety of standards organizations on the international side above the dotted line and U.S. counterparts for the ones in blue and yellow. So, for example, ISO and IEC formed JTC1 about more than two decades ago. And that's called Joint Technical Committee 1. There is no JTC2. Under JTC1, there's a whole host of subcommittees that deal with different aspects of IT. The key one for cybersecurity is SC27, but there are other SCs that touch on cybersecurity. And those international bodies in their processes and in ITU processes run by country-based representation. So in JTC1, we talk about a national body process, and if you want to get involved in the U.S., you have to join the Insights Committee, which is accredited by ANSI. And the mirror committees are down here. So, for example, SC27's U.S. mirror is called CS1. If you wanted to do another traditional international organization that is run in this country-based process, ITUT is an example, and SG17 is where they do some security work, and the State Department is the U.S. counterpart to that. Then you have a whole host of international organizations that don't run by, like that. It's one individual, one vote, one company, one vote, and they run very differently. That's the less traditional, more modern, although those organizations have been around for a long time, too. This is a first attempt, I should say, that based on things I've seen even in the past 2 days, we already know that this is not pointing out the key standards, IoT activities, but here's to give you a flavor that there is an activity in JTC1. We know about an IEEE activity, P2413. I heard about others. IETF, OASIS, a lot of other consortia have activities in this area. You may be asking yourselves, where should I go to develop a standard? So the advice we like to give is that you should be looking for places where the experts convene and places that have a track record for developing standards in a particular area, and ones that do that in a timely and a cost-efficient manner. So just to give you a little more information about how to make that decision, you want to think about where is a community of interest convening already. If they're not already convening somewhere, it's too new. You want to find out where do stakeholders want to convene. Is there a place, a likely venue, or more than one venue where people will go join? The other question here is about the track record. If there's no track record, but the entrepreneurial people in the administration of a standards organization are trying to lure stakeholders into their organization and start new work, you might want to think twice about whether or not that's the right place to do standards work. Doing things in the most efficient manner possible really depends on where you are in the drafting process. If you're starting with an outline or a blank sheet of paper, maybe you don't want to go straight into a standards organization. Maybe you'd like to do something less formal, maybe with some allies, get together, start to draft or vet something in an informal or formal process, and then take it to a standards organization. If you want to start with a blank sheet of paper in a standards organization because you want to make sure you have an open process with a balanced group of stakeholders from the get-go, pick an organization that meets frequently. A lot of these international organizations meet twice a year. It's not very efficient for getting something done when you have a blank sheet of paper. On the other hand, if you have a document that's already widely used and accepted, you can think about some other options, like are there standards organizations that have expedited processes so you can fast track a document. So final point, there's an ongoing issue, as I was alluding to, that a lot of these standards organizations want to do work in the next hot new area. So you got turf battles, and you'll hear different standards organizations saying that they're the leading IT standards place. You need to come do new work in IoT or big data or cloud over here. This happens. Even stakeholders take advantage of this because they don't want to do work with one set of people, and they want to go over to another place and where they think it's friendlier to their agenda. The old joke is, you know, you have N number of standards, that's crazy, but at least it's not 15. So it's something that the community has to deal with, and there's no Uber standards management system that's going to try to squash that. It's just part of the game. And that's my final point. Thank you.
Next, I'm going to ask Mark Underwood. I'm going in the order of general to more and more specific speakers on different issues.
I don't think I need to introduce you. I've abused everyone here already. So I'm going to give everyone the benefit of not having to look at my slide decks this time. I put into the chat four links to things that are public on the web. Two of them are standards groups that I've worked in for the last year and a half with NIST. It's a public data working group on big data. It's the reason that I'm here, because I learned about the ontology work group and the summit's work out of that other standards work. So it's the reason that I'm here. These standards bodies, or SDOs as some people call them, are kind of tentacles that reach out through cross-disciplinary methods into
different ways of connecting across disciplines, and that's fun. It's really one of the neat things about the standards organizations. And even the standards that never go anywhere do achieve some of that synergy, so it's very good. So the first two of those links are working documents for the NIST Data Working Group. What's surprising, if you look, and by the way, the public version of that, which didn't go on the Federal Register, went through a different vehicle. The public documents, which are quite long, on the order of 350 pages or so, were produced by a team that's fairly small, including all the people worked on it, maybe under 50 people, with probably five or six key editors. The takeaway from that is a small number of people can do a lot. And it's premature to say where that standard will go and what its relevance is to the larger community, but it's proceeded now to several. We've had two review panels with JTC1. Basically, the U.S. committee work is leading the charge so far. The way this thing's playing out. So I think it's interesting to know that people like the folks in this room could make a difference in this or some other future standards organization. The other link there is to the HL7 ontology. I thought it would be useful to point that out because it's the effort of a standards organization. I think they're official one, aren't they? You think of them as, yeah. So you can see what a standards organization did with baking into an ontology as part of the standard by looking at their working documents. The last thing is a working document for the Security and Privacy Group that I'm the co-chair of in the NIST Big Data Working Group. And it's a list of the standards that we are trying to keep track of. And the reason I bring this up here is that the absence of an ontology that works across security and privacy realms is a big handicap for standards organizations. Because think about what I have to do as an author of a standard. I have to look at every document basically as prose. I can't leverage any structure because, the NIST 800 series document may have a dissimilar structure to one of that OASIS produces, and even across the OASIS world, there's no canonical format even for the document structures, never mind the metadata indexing that is associating the documents. In other words, there's no standards of standards documents. So what you have is, if you go to that last link I provided, it's a spreadsheet with a list of a bunch of documents that I have to go read and create my own metadata about and hyperlinks into so that we can have orderly conversations about what work the other standards are doing. Now, why is that important? Because we don't want to reinvent the wheel. I think the dead end for a lot of standards organizations is trying to do something somebody else has already solved, or I like that terminology Michael used in another discussion, which is the wreckage of other projects. That's a useful artifact to know about because you can save yourself a lot of energy by saying, oh, somebody else looked at that, they actually got funded to try to solve it, they couldn't do it. Even if the conclusions were non-technical, that's useful to know. That's extremely valuable information. It could be the standards, were in conflict with industrial standards. It could, there's a multitude of reasons. All of them are somewhat interesting to look at. Probably could write a history book about standards in the U.S. over the past 50 years and it would be good required reading for people working in the standards organizations. So the reason I wanted to bring this up is I think this group might have something to contribute through NIST or perhaps completely parallel to NIST as developing an ontology about the standards because we don't have any automated tooling that we can use to examine the standards with, that I know of anyway. So it would be extremely useful in the security and privacy space because we have so many people doing frameworks that are new. And a whole bunch of other frameworks produced by the standards organizations and also by the professional societies. So I want to mention the work of the professional societies and the certifiers because people like ISACA and SANS and other people working in the security and privacy space are certifying professionals with a body of knowledge that's been adjudicated through their membership. And that becomes a de facto standard for what you're supposed to know to operate in that field. So there's a mapping in there, and they have their own. You would not argue the body of knowledge is an ontology of some sort, and you should be able to map the body of knowledge that a professional society has for certifying something into what is in some of the standards that are out there. As far as I know, nobody's doing that either, and so it's really somewhat of an ontological undertaking to try to do that. So I'll stop here because I'm interested in what the other panelists have to say. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
I think just the two talks raised interesting questions. I'll get Eric Simmons, who's a systems expert in the Electronic Information Group at NIST. He's been there since 1990. He's been part of a number of standards groups, and he's also leading the effort in cyber-physical cloud computing, and he's co-chair for the NIST Cyber-Physical Systems.
I've had some interesting presentations already, some interesting discussions over the last couple of days. I figured I would get a little philosophical since I think we've got some good nuts and bolts about standards already. I'll talk a bit about standards. When I originally wrote this or put this together, I wasn't exactly sure where I was going to go with this. And what I ended up with is we really need ontologies to support standards and the Internet of Things. So I thought I'd start at the beginning. And Elaine gave a nice, more formal definition or explanation about standards. And here's a very general one. And what I find quite ironic and amusing is there isn't any universally or widely accepted definition for standards. But this one's pretty good, and it works to understand the concept and why we need them. So a universally or widely accepted, agreed upon, or established means of determining what something should be. And I look at this, and it's very interesting because that sounds like what we do with ontologies. Now, a lot of people talk about standards, and they talk about them in a negative way. I often hear that standards get in the way of progress. They're too constraining, they're too restrictive, they prevent us from innovating. But in actuality, I think good standards do the exact opposite. And a good example is early industrial standardization, standardizing the screw. Originally, screwed threads, you know, a nut and a bolt, were hand machined, handmade, and that didn't work very well. You had to make each one, and you had to make the nut fit the bolt. Well, then we had a screw cutting lathe. We got to move a little bit further. Each manufacturer would produce a nut and a bolt, and that was better because at least the same manufacturer's nut and bolts would fit together. So if you bought something, it would theoretically have all the same nut and bolts and everything would work. If you needed a replacement though, or if you wanted to customize something, if you wanted to innovate, well, all of a sudden it doesn't work so well. You have to go and find the specific nut and bolt from that manufacturer, or maybe you have to make a new nut and bolt. So for every new customization, you were again forced to go back and create things from scratch, rebuild the wheel. Finally, we got to the point where we actually created some standards for the nuts and the bolts. And this really drove the second, or was one of the major drivers for the second industrial wave. And certainly was a major technology supporting assembly lines. So now let's move on to the cyber world, computers, and the internet. We did the same thing for networking and the internet, connecting computers together. We built some standards. Originally, they were designed to connect a few big mainframes together, but we pretty quickly realized that they were flexible, and we got new types of computers, small personal computers that we want to connect. And it turns out that we made the standards pretty robust to begin with, extensible. And what did that lead to? It's led to the last 20 years of just amazing innovation and change to to the point that our society and our world today is vastly different than it was when this was started. So that brings us to today. So we've standardized and innovated in the physical world. We've standardized and innovated in the cyber world. Well, now we're talking about the Internet of Things, the next big thing, right? We're connecting the physical world to the information world. We're sensing the physical space. We're creating knowledge, processing, and then acting on that information back in the physical space. So again, we're in a situation where we'd really like to have some standardization that will help us innovate in this new cyber-physical space. And it's interesting because if we look at the definitions or some of the core characteristics that we expect Internet of Things and cyber-physical systems to have, we have things like interoperable, heterogeneous, shared resources, adaptable systems. They also need to be describable and reliable. And if I look at some of the, you know, core ontology papers, Michael's 1996 paper on ontologies talks about how ontologies help support things like interoperability and reusability, shareability. Now, if we look at the other side of things, if we look at the environment for IoT, we find a very complex and fog-ridden environment. We have many different stakeholder groups. We have many different application domains. And since we're talking about standards, something that's very interesting is a lot of these application domains have their own standards bodies. We have the big international standards bodies, but within each type of application, you might have a separate standards body as well. Finally, we have the supporting technologies. And there, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of supporting technologies for the Internet of Things. So this all leads to a very complex environment, ecosystem of domains, technologies, and stakeholders. Again, they all have different requirements. They all come with different backgrounds, speaking different jargons, different viewpoints, and having made different assumptions. Just the type of situation that ontologies are supposed to help with. These challenges also cause problems, difficulty in defining requirements, and that relates very specifically with standards. Also, limited interoperability and limited potential for reuse. A lot of wasted effort, and when we're talking about cyber-physical systems, we're also talking about potential for not just corrupt data, but physical damage and even physical harm and possible death. So the consequence of messing up when we start talking about CPS and IoT is much more severe. So, of course, there's a lot of standards work going on in IoT. A lot of standardization at the technology level. IoT isn't going to be one standard. It's going to be thousands of standards that make up the environment. But there's still standardization work that needs to be done. A lot of it is going to happen on the overview, the architectural level, how to put these systems of systems together, how to get the heterogeneity to work. To that end, I'm currently participating in three efforts that are worth mentioning and following several others. I'm working with the IEEE on their P2413 project, which is looking at IoT architecture. I also participate in the ISO IEC, the JTC1 that Elaine mentioned earlier. Working Group 10, Internet of Things Working Group. They also are looking at concepts that they talk about as far as reference architectures, and I'll get to that term in a minute. I also, surprisingly, participate in the NIST Cyber Physical Systems Public Working Group. And I have to make a small correction of what Mark was mentioning earlier. The work that NIST is doing is from a NIST perspective anyway, not standards work. It's guidance work. It's very important work that we would like to get into one of the accredited standards bodies, but we don't consider it standards work by itself. Although, if you look at the definition I provided earlier, it may meet that need for certain scenarios and situations. So this work is very important, and yet it's been done in a very traditional method, as in most standards. We get together in a room with a bunch of experts, and we talk about it until we come up with something we like, and then we publish it as a standard. So we take all the complexity of the IoT domain, and we add a bunch of experts that come from different backgrounds, speaking not just different technical languages, but different natural languages. And we ask them to develop these standards. Well, you can see this list looks just like the one for IoT, with maybe even some additional complexity. So we're in a situation where we have a system, an environment that we want to build that could really use ontological support. We have an environment that exists that is causing confusion and obfuscates what we're trying to achieve and what we want to understand, making shared understanding, shared knowledge very difficult to obtain. So we'd really like to use ontologies and ontological tools to improve the process. And I can say that's not being done very well right now. I think there's a lot of reasons for that, mostly driven by resources. Almost all of those experts are volunteers, even if they're sent by their companies. It's usually the second or third part of their job. And the standards organizations themselves don't have a lot of resources to train experts and to provide resources for them to develop standards. I thought I'd finish up by talking about some of the semantic issues that we're currently running into. And Judith made the comment that these aren't ontological issues, they're philosophical issues. But these, to my mind, are low-hanging fruit. If we can't even agree on these simple base concepts, such as what is IoT, how does it different from cyber-physical systems? How does cyber-physical systems today differ from the past? Is there a difference between a cyber-physical system that's embedded versus distributed? What is a thing? Right, we had part of this discussion yesterday, and I wasn't here, but I really wanted to speak up because I like things to be physical and virtual and cyber-physical at the same time. And we definitely had a difference of opinion there. Even things like device, the IOTA effort in the EU has defined device as the cyber-physical thing, the thing that senses and acts, whereas many other people would define it in a much more generic fashion. Now, if we turn to the standards side, trying to understand what these groups are even doing, because the idea of these groups is not to develop a architecture, but an environment for creating architectures and for creating CPS. and people don't have clarity or agreement on the term architecture or architectural framework or reference architecture. In the CPS reference architecture group right now, we're having a big discussion on what the term model means. Networking is one that's up for discussion. Co-design comes up a lot, and yet nobody I've seen has yet been able to sufficiently define it. They can give examples, but they can't tell me what it is. And even the concept of system is something that's hotly debated. So if we can't solve these simple semantic issues, you can see that there's a lot of much more complex, in-depth semantic issues that could be really improved by the application of ontological solutions. And I'll finish up with this definition that can shows what happens when a standards process doesn't meet its goals. So this is a definition for the Internet of Things, and it goes, an infrastructure of interconnected objects, people, systems, and information resources, together with intelligent services, to allow them to process information of the physical and virtual world and react. I'll end with that.
Thank you, Eric. The next person is going to be Harry Foxwell. He's a principal consultant at Oracle Public Sector Division in Washington, and he's responsible for solutions, consulting, and customer education on cloud computing, operating systems, and virtual technologies. He writes a lot of computing reviews, which are quite interesting, and I will pass it to you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. To add a little more to the introduction, I worked for Sun Microsystems for 15 years. Almost feels like 50 sometimes. Worked for Sun Microsystems for 15 years, and then, as many of you may know, Oracle acquired Sun about 5 years ago, and so now I'm with Oracle. To follow up on a couple of comments that were made earlier, standards help companies like Oracle compete, and in particular to compete in the government market. When a customer, an agency says, I want to buy a cloud, what the heck does that mean? And whenever I give presentations to customers about cloud technology, and the same thing is true of my competitors at HP and Amazon and Google and IBM, in the government space, they basically say, hey, look at the standards that were defined by, the committees that said, here's what cloud computing means. And then we can compete, because we all know that when an RFP comes out, we know the meanings of the words. I must say I have participated in the working groups for cloud computing and lately big data. I kind of gravitate towards the infrastructure and reference architecture working groups. I try to stay away from the ontology and taxonomy working groups. They're all a bunch of PhDs that know about ontologies and argue endlessly about the meanings of words. But ultimately, the meanings of words, come down to, can we agree upon what a thing is so that we can compete and sell in the marketplace? Presentation, I've got very, very short comments about what I might consider to be the poster child for the evolution of a related technology to Internet of Things. So some things are very, very scary. Okay, I put that little painting down here because this is a scary evolution of where we're going in the future with the Internet. I'm not quite sure where these numbers came from, what the citation is, but I don't think they are, you know, that far off, you know, even if they're off by an order of magnitude. These are pretty scary numbers, all right? Billions or trillions of devices connected to the Internet, all talking to each other in some manner, the Internet of Things, and generating, you know, enormous amounts of data. So what are we going to do about that? And more specifically, what have we started to do about it in earlier implementations, which I'm going to talk a little bit about. So when we're developing standards for, you know, trying to deal with these IT evolutionary changes that happen, we don't always know where it's going. People didn't know where cloud computing was going or where big data was going. So, you know, it's kind of like a process where you define something, you see if that works. If it doesn't work, you go another direction. Ultimately, you get some progress, but not necessarily understand where the final goal is, because we don't really know where some of these things are leading us. They're time-consuming. It takes a long time to, you know, agree upon vocabulary, agree upon what the term is being, agree upon the technology to implement those things. A lot of false starts and a lot of special interests that are driving those needs. It's both a collaborative and a competitive process. Vendors are very, very interested in, you know, selling their stuff and making sure that the other guy can't sell his stuff. So we have, you know, vendors competing about defining what a standard is and how to exploit those standards and make sure that other people can exploit them. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics in the need to cooperate in order to sell stuff into a market that wants the standard and the need to have competitive advantage. So that also complicates the development of these de facto or ultimately de jure standards. We want the standards to be widely accepted and used and in certain cases enforced. Now, I use the word enforced in the sense that, you know, when an RFP comes out, the standard language says you must follow this particular standard for this particular technology, otherwise you're not going to, you know, be able to sell your stuff to the government. So that's one kind of enforcement that we see in standards. A standard requires at least a common vocabulary, common ontology. It also requires some early adoption, a reference implementation, lots and lots of use cases that say, here's how we are going to make this work, and has to have champions, has to have promotion of those of that particular standard. So the use case in point that I want to talk about is something that I got involved in at the beginning of my career at Sun. I was hired at Sun in 1995, Java was introduced to the world. And over time, Java became very, very popular, partly because of its lofty goal of, some of you may have heard the marketing term that Sun used at the time, write once, run anywhere. How many of you heard about that? Okay. It kind of morphed into write once, debug everywhere. But generally speaking, it had a very lofty goal of making sure that no matter what kind of device, no matter what kind of infrastructure you were running on, that you could do something with Java to make that happen. Ultimately, that allowed evolution to what I would think of as the early implementation of the Internet of Things. In fact, Kevin Ashton was credited with the phrase Internet of Things in 1999, and that's no accident because just at that particular time frame, Sun came out with the ability to embed Java into small devices and actually do the kind of sensing types of devices that we see today in Internet of Things with Java built into them, either Java directly or Java running in a small implementation of Linux running on a small device. That was called Genie. Turns out that Sun was a bit, you know, ahead of the game. Genie kind of faded away for a little while, and now it's actually back in a new form. So I would like to say that in terms of Internet of Things, we've been there and done that. Now we're not quite finished, and I was going to say been there, done that, got the T-shirt, but Sun Microsystems used to give away T-shirts. I've got a whole collection of them at home. Oracle doesn't give away T-shirts, so don't look for Oracle T-shirts about the Internet of Things. So when you're developing a standard in an evolutionary manner from a technology that you've already been promoting and seems to be very popular, okay, and in particular for something like the Internet of Things, the Gini implementation, you need to actually have this ontology of saying, this is what this technology means, this is what it talks to, this is what it refers to. You need to be able to say, this is what a device is. We were just talking about what, you know, what's a device, what's a thing. You have to, you know, define those terms. What's a service? So first the taxonomy that basically says here's what this particular term means. The ontology that defines the relationships among those. In fact, there's some people probably arguing about what a taxonomy or an ontology is. But in any case, you have to define your terms and then implement them in a technology proof of concept and then have that move along. So. When we invented Gini in Sun Microsystems, we actually developed this taxonomy and ontology of how we refer to the things that can be talked to on the Internet. We define devices, service discovery, self-registration of devices, advertising and what the capabilities of the devices are, context awareness, so making sure that the devices understood their position in time and in space. What data formats they dealt with, what kind of repositories there were for the information about these objects. So we had an object store called JavaSpaces, and then implemented in a language with a set of APIs that were, you know, commonly available and sometimes open sourced. In fact, much of Java today is open sourced. Define the syntax of how you talk to these objects. And provide development tools. Early on, there were development tools like Java Beans, NetBeans rather, or Eclipse from IBM, tools that were allowed to actually write the code and a broad-based support for that kind of widespread support for that particular language. The desire out of that. Was to have in emphasizing its use today in Internet of Things, is to leverage the experience and the expertise that's out there now. So this is something that we've already done, already gone through, and I don't know that we could characterize some of it as wreckage. I think some of it is really, really quite useful. So lots of developers out there that know Java, lots of reference implementations for all different kind of things that happens on the Internet. Some rather large and active communities, lots of education resources, a lot of vendor support, not just from Sun and Oracle. So over time, because of the widespread use of Java, there was a necessity for multi-vendor support for that particular de facto standard, if you will. And the net result of that was an organization that was founded, I think, in 1999, called the Java Community Process. And today we have, over 25 committee members, executive committee members, including most of the major manufacturers of hardware and software, the Eclipse Foundation, Fujitsu, HP, IBM, Intel, Oracle, of course, Red Hat, a number of others. We have a large and active contributing membership. I've got a pointer there to that list of memberships. The result over time, since the introduction of Java in 1995 to what we have today, is an implementation of Java that's widely accepted as a standard way of embedding software into devices and using it for the Internet of Things. The most recent implementation was introduced in March, Java 8, the Java 8 Embedded Edition and the Java 8 Standard Edition for embedding inside of these small devices. We also provide the software development kits, emulators, like you saw the emulator a moment ago, in order to help people to develop and create things in emulators and then deploy them to the devices, and then have a lot of reference implementations for different kinds of things that you can do with the language. So I'm not quite sure you can see all of the little text on this. The Java Community Process, 15 years now or so, is the collaborative effort to standardize how people add things to Java, including adding the technologies for Internet of Things, actually leveraging a lot of what we learned from the development of Genie. Over 800 global members, community participants, subcommittees, and so on that drive the standardization of the language and allow it to evolve in a common way, not just by one particular vendor. So I'll kind of wrap up a little bit here. Some useful reading. Oracle has evolved the support for the idea of Internet of Things with the use of the Java technologies that were introduced in Java 8. So we have the Java and IoT papers that have been published. A couple of them are the Intelligent Platform for the Connected Vehicle, Internet of Things related to the automobile industry, another one for the industrial economy, another white paper there, a general one about Oracle and the Internet of Things. The specification, this is more specific, the specification for Genie, which is now an Apache project. We kind of took some of those efforts and donated them to the Apache Foundation, and they're now the ones that drive the standardization and the definition and the reference architectures for that particular technology. And to be fair, we're not the only ones that are driving this technology, so I added the IBM down there. They have the IoT Foundation that builds a Java client library for supporting this kind of activity as well. So to wrap up, back to the idea that we have so many things that are out there. How are we going to actually make that use that effectively? Well, one way, we think, is to leverage what we've already done with the Java and Genie technology, expand it. If you take a look at what's in the embedded devices that we have out there on the internet with these small devices, typically the embedded systems are either direct Java virtual machines or their implementation of a small instance of Linux with a Java virtual machine embedded in that. So Java is going to be pervasive in this internet of things. It's not going to go away. It's probably going to get bigger, especially since we have so many more devices that are going to be out there and so much data that we're going to be collecting. And then the last comment I have to make here is that this Internet of Things is going to make this idea of big data even more important to understand and implement. We're still going to need standards for the ontologies and reference architectures for big data to understand all the stuff that this Internet of Things is going to be generating for us. So I think that's the end of my comments. We'll answer some questions then. Okay.
Thank you.
The last speaker is Dr. Colin Suter. He's currently a senior manager with Deloitte Cyber Risk Services Practice. He was a chief technology officer for over a decade with Bioscript, a biometric public company based in Toronto. He currently provides management guidance to several federal clients, including NIST's Program for National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. And he will present a case study of the biometrics standards process he has gone through himself. Thank you.
Thanks, Sub, and good afternoon. So as Sub mentioned, I was asked to present a little bit of a sort of lessons learned, scrapes and bruises and stuff from the biometrics industry in the way that they evolved some of the core standards. I try to look for some analogous situations, so hopefully this will spark some further discussion. I won't take too long. We'll leave some time for the Q&A for the other speakers as well. So most of the material I'm going to talk about today was based on the time that I spent as the chief technology officer of a biometric company. I started in that industry about the mid-90s or so, early 90s, I guess it was, and sort of I've moved away from that more into a broader identity, privacy, cybersecurity type environment. I moved away from being a vendor. So I feel I can look back on it now and try and understand some of the lessons learned that we went through as we were trying to develop standards. And, much to some of the other points Harry and Elaine in particular a lot of these things were motivated by customers. We were a vendor. At the time, I guess the mid to late 90s, there was probably 200, 250 biometric vendors that all had the best technology in the world, and they could all absolutely guarantee error rates of, you know, 100%. Error rates of 0%, I should say. Accuracy of 100%. And, but of course, it was untested. I would say that, you know, the tragic events of 9/11, the unfortunate events there really precipitated some of the broader interest in using biometric technologies. In going through that decade between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s, that number of about 250 companies was reduced down to probably a dozen or so organizations. Now, some of that was just natural evolution. We used to joke you're either reading the menu at that time or you're on the menu. There was a lot of M&A going on. We were acquired in 2008. The company that acquired us had acquired about four companies before and about four others afterwards until they were acquired 3 or 4 years ago. So that rationalization of the industry was likely to occur anyway because there was a lot of competing technologies there. But then once standards were developed, to Harry's point in particular, the standards were then used as a metric. People could understand how well these technologies worked. And the interesting thing about biometric technologies relative to, at least in my opinion, relative to what's going on with the Internet of Things and ontology, is that inherently biometric systems are classification systems. So we're trying to reconcile whether a sample that is presented is from a valid user or someone that's masquerading as that valid user. It really just comes down to how well you do that classification. And the biometric companies, of course, had a myriad of different ways of doing that classification, 250 different ways, as I said earlier. When, in the late 2001, as a consequence of 9/11, there was an attempt to set up both a U.S. national committee and then subsequent to that, an international committee, as Elaine mentioned, ISO SC37, as it's known. That was when really the biometric vendors were forced to talk more openly to each other and get into all those challenges of retaining some degree of technology innovation, but allowing interoperability that was mandated by the upcoming procurements by the federal government. So it really forced the vendors to get together and make some very hard choices. I remember one situation probably in about 2003 or so, as a company, Bioscript, the company I was with, I sat in a boardroom and I had to explain to the board why we needed to make a contribution that would basically forego some of our intellectual property, throw it out into the public domain for the betterment of the industry and ultimately, as time told, but not at that particular time, for the betterment of the company. It enabled us to survive as a company. Otherwise, literally, we were the beta versus the VHS in terms of standards development. So we needed to make some drastic changes, and the board bought into it. I can't say it was unanimous at the time, but over time, they realized that that was the right thing to do. So the point I'm making there is that, you know, the standards development sort of fought out in the trenches, really. Once company, you know, especially with, as I understand, the evolving technology and the devices, you know, the numbers that are up there in terms of the different devices that are capable of being addressed and of supporting Internet of Things, collecting data, is clearly an entirely heterogeneous environment. And there are a lot of different corporate interests at play. And the success of the overall industry, of course, is that those corporations survive and that they do well and they thrive. So that's the real balance that we saw in biometrics, and I think you'll likely encounter with Internet of Things, is trying to maintain that appropriate balance of technology innovation versus interoperability, in essence, the ability to interchange different vendors' products. So the second sort of point that I want to make here, I guess it was about the mid-2000s or so, you know, I like to feel that I did a lot of good work in the biometrics industry, created some patents, developed technologies and so on. One of the things that unfortunately I was known for was the famous onion diagram that was presented to one of the ISO committees, SC37, in the mid-2000s or so. So it was kind of a joke. You know, it was an onion, and it talked about the different layers. But I think it is actually highly appropriate to consider that. So the way that we were looking at it was the initial development of standards for biometric technologies was really at the API, the application programming interface layer. And I kind of see that analogous as someone who's trying to develop an application and want to touch different parts of the Internet of Things. So they've got various devices that they want to address. the discussions that we got into at that point, much to Eric, what Eric mentioned, was, really, well, first of all, what do you mean by device? What do you mean by system? How are we going to define, you know, what the system comprises? And then it essentially got broken down over time into a set of five core functions. And, you know, that took probably about 6 months or so to develop. But over that time, it really was whittled down into those five core functions. So that was the beginning of the standards. And then there was deeper pressure applied. You go down to the next level. The next level is probably, you know, vocabulary. Then you get into the next layer, which is really talking about things like confidentiality, integrity, system performance, and so on. The next layer down onto that, and this is where I think you start to touch actual devices in IoT. You start talking about data format. And initially, we were all very tentative. The data formats were simply the schema. You know, how are we going to write this data? How is it going to be represented? Once we all got to know each other, and once we understood, again, the bigger prize that was available, we got right to the core of the matter, which was actually defining the data that could be interchanged between different systems. So that actually meant you could enroll on one biometric vendor's device and then verify on another. Seems very straightforward and logical, but prior to those events, none of the vendors, again, wanted to open up and actually share that information. So I think there is some value in actually sort of considering it as a, you know, as cores, various cores of the onion. Because I think there are different layers, as I understand it, again, in terms of APIs, addressing different devices, accessing the data from those devices in a particular way, sharing that data. Like, you could really start to think about how you create a family of standards. And one of the reasons that I'm, you know, suggesting a family of standards is that there's a number of different interests at play in terms of how standards evolve, and some of the previous speakers touched on those. It really needs to be at the right time and in the right place. You need to create an environment where the vendors want to come together and understand the value in coming together, and feel that they can, feel it's a protected environment to actually create that standard. That might mean that you're best not to create a standard at the deepest core initially. It might mean that, for example, you start at the API layer because that's where everyone feels comfortable interoperating. Then as you get into deeper issues that touch more on proprietary considerations, people know each other by that. I mean, it really comes down to people sitting in a room and trusting and talking with each other to enable that. So you might want to consider at what layer, what level you want to start to develop standards. Once you've done that, then I think you start to look at the questions that Elaine brought up, is, you know, what's the best environment for it? So again, companies are coming in, and we're now seeing this more recently. I've been more recently supporting, as Sub mentioned, you know, broader identity programs, the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace. Also, there's another initiative, the Cybersecurity Framework that NIST had developed. Companies are coming to these types of workshops, and they want to know that they're collaborating together in a trusted environment. They want to know, for example, what the IP provisions are if they have to sign an agreement. They want to know, you know, what happens to the information they share. Is it going to be made public afterwards? Should it be made public? And oftentimes, if it's comments coming back, they want it to be public, and they want to see the disposition of those comments. So a lot of the ground rules that the organization has, you know, in terms of appeals process, consensus process, all of these different considerations, they need to be considered in terms of where the organizations are going to come together to develop the standards. As I said, maybe to sort of think about, you know, the correct layer of standardization would be important too. The last part, and this was a word that I noted Elaine used a number of times, and appropriately so, is drivers. There needs to be a business driver for the companies to come together and collaborate. Whether that's a big procurement, and frankly, for biometrics, it was. It was, you know, again, the tragic events of 9/11, the U.S. government implemented a FIPS, a federal processing standard, to enable federal employees and contracts to use a common badge, and that had biometric technologies on it. To allow them to put the technologies on, they needed to have a common interchange format. And so that was the driver that brought people together. So it's critical. Because I'm seeing this in the identity space, there's a lot of interest, but there's not the same business drivers that are driving the companies to come to the table and share their information. So with that, I'll stop, and I guess we'll open it up for questions.
Well,
Well, you can either sit in your place and answer questions or come in the front. Either is fine with me. While they take a seat, I just want to mention a couple of things. My first encounter to ontologies was in 1990 when I was finishing my PhD, where I was encoding the welfare laws into logic. And in the process of looking at how do you update these welfare laws, we realized that we need an ontology because there were 13 different definitions of family in the welfare laws. And you would be very surprised as to the number of definitions that pervade welfare laws. And subsequently, I worked with Alcoa in trying to integrate three divisions of theirs: material testing, product testing, and chemical testing. And it was quite an exercise over 3 years trying to get the terminology across three divisions just in material science. None of the definitions matched, so there were about 100 databases. So it seems like ontology is still struggling. The reason that project stopped was the amount of effort required to maintain the underlying ontology and evolve. And I think Michael raised very similar questions about the evolution of ontologies and other issues. One question I have to start with, actually it's directed at Mark and everybody, is do you think an ontology should accompany every standard in some form or the other, which will make it easier for people to understand what is in the standards? So I'll start with that question and the rest we can. Anybody wants to answer anything? Mark?
Can a non-panelist offer some ideas?
Yeah, I think I expressed my view. Whether the thing that we came up with was actually an ontology that would satisfy the subcommunity that's convened at this summit,
mm-hmm.
might not meet that standard.
Mm-hmm.
But something that's moving in that direction of something that was a machine understandable, canonical structure that mapped domains that are essentially similar, like cybersecurity is a great domain for that. You know, do we have to find out the different terminologies and do the interoperating of the mapping of these different terminologies ourselves? And all these standards organizations then, you know, go through the very painful and convoluted arguments about which of the terminologies to use. And if they had them all sitting in front of them, they could pick from a menu, have their dispute and be done with it, and shorten a lot of these debates that they have in conversations. So they're not always debates. It's just sometimes doing the research to get this otherwise inaccessible information.
No, that's one of the problems and the confusions occur are associated, I think, with ontologies. Ontologies are not about terminologies. In the sense that terminologies are human natural language terms that particular communities understand, they think they know what it means, right? Well, that's my interpretation. The ontology is supposed to represent or can represent the concepts to which terminologies can be applied and be valid. And I've been on these committees where a simple term, you can devolve into wonderful discussions that don't go anywhere. And you have to recognize that at some point that this discussion is a waste of time. It's probably not crucial that you have this beautiful definition that everyone in the world will agree to, but just to start out with, have something that people are not going to violently disagree with and just move on from there, because one of the issues I see is that people do not necessarily understand the concept that they think they're trying to represent by some natural language term. And you have to get at that concept, and that's not a simple thing to do, but as an ontologist, there are tools that can be used to uncover that, if it's not apparently obvious. And certainly if you're not a domain expert in the field, that gives you a better view because you don't know anything. It's easier to ask the questions to find out what the experts think they're thinking.
Yeah, so I was thinking, Abe, in the context of, for example, the vocabulary that Eric put up, what does thing mean in the context of IoT? It would be, I think, the wrong direction to go to expect, okay, we just reach out and grab the best ontology. Really, ontologies come out of ontological analysis, and that's the first step that you have to go through. You have to really start to analyze these. Now, you might use existing ontologies such as Dolce to find thing, and see why, how you want to specify it or specialize it or relate it to other things. But you have to go through an ontological analysis as part of that. And people, a lot of people will talk about that and think about that in terms of conceptual analysis, a related idea. But you can do conceptual analysis and then have a more ontologically oriented analysis to produce an ontology. You can do a conceptual analysis to produce essentially a human understanding of what you guys mean in the meeting. And that's really the first step, because you don't go to a formalized ontology without having a human understanding about what you want formalized yet.
And I was just going to mention something related to what Ed was saying, that I think in the standards environment, the discussions often go the wrong way. They start at the term and then define what the concepts are based on the term, not try to figure out what concepts are, and then come up with the appropriate term. And it's a huge problem.
Yeah, I would add a little bit to what was said a moment ago. The problem is which comes first. You know, does the philosophical discussion of what, you know, these terms are come first, or does the actual action and tools and products and implementations comes first? And in the case of Java, and then that the evolution of Java into this Internet of Things idea, the technology came first, and then the arguments about, you know, what do we call these things that we're talking to? Yeah.
But Harry, in the case of Java, they started out with this wonderful requirement. You want to be OS independent. And from that very strong requirement, many of the possible discussions that could have taken place weren't necessary because they were that strong requirement.
Yeah, I would agree with that high-level approach. But when we started to saying, okay, now we're going to have Java embedded in this thing or Java service that says I'm going to embed information in a printer so the printer can wake up and say, hey, I'm a printer, and I'm going to advertise my service all over the net. Those ideas actually bubbled up before anybody had a good handle on how to categorize these services and objects that Java was enabling people to talk to. So the technology kind of came first, and then it drove the need for standards, and then it kind of started this cycle of, you know, a term needed to be, you know, invented to describe this particular action or device, and it kind of was a back and forth development process.
And if you recall, almost 20 years ago, it was 1998 or so, you led a demonstration of Genie at the old Sun facility at McLean. Do you remember that? Okay. Now,
yes, I do remember that.
The reason I bring that up is because I thought it was great. And actually, when I heard about this, the subject for this year's summit about the Internet of Things, I asked you, what about Genie? You going to bring that up? And I got these blank stares for the most part. But in any case, the reason I bring up that demonstration is because after that demonstration, I was so intrigued, I asked whichever person you brought in from California there, how another device would know a printer is a printer. And I ended up badgering the person for I don't know how long because I couldn't articulate the question properly. And they said effectively that, oh, we don't have a semantic solution. You have to know a priori that it's whatever it is. Have a nice day. So Genie did not solve the semantic problem,
right,
but they had wonderful infrastructure.
I'll just add that I'm thinking along the lines that Harry is and the gentleman. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, Todd. You can do these things concurrently. I wouldn't hold up one over the other. I can think of biometric examples. This is how I know Colin, why I've dragged him here. Of, like, for example, in terminology, we talk about the end of the biometric process. People still say that you're taking two samples and matching them, and people would constantly talk about matching algorithms. That's the wrong terminology because it assumes the decision that it's a match versus a non-match. And then in round two or generation three of the standards, we've gone back and changed that so we're talking about comparisons or comparator algorithms. Just an example.
That's an example of the terminology you got in the way of the concept.
I hate to be the one advocating for pragmatism, but I guess So what you're saying to the poor schmo like me who's trying to understand what's in the standards is that I have to know a priori what to go look for in natural language and do Google searches in these documents in order to create structure out of it, and that the standards developers are not willing to create structures in the documents for me. So the NIST discipline for the group that I'm a member of is to create a taxonomy. But what is the taxonomy? Is it a Word document? Is it a spreadsheet? Is it, you know, what it is not is an ontology. It's not even, you know, it's not even a generation or two removed from that. So the pragmatic requirement here is expose the meaning in a practical way for other people working with the standard, either as deployers, as developers, people working on new standards, or implementers. But it's not a self-contained solution that you can satisfy by saying, well, because it's not a legitimate ontology, you won't have any structure in the document.
Yeah, maybe just to pick up on that point. Just to pick up on that point, though, it's like people think that the meaning is in the definition, the natural language definition, and it's more in what you're saying, it's exposing the meaning in terms of, well, what do you mean by an object? Well, a physical object. A physical object has a size, it has a mass. Does it consume power? Well, no, not all physical objects consume power. Oh, what's a device? Well, does the device consume power? You know, it's a subclass of physical object because it has all those other attributes, but it also consumes power. And it's more, so what do you mean by a particular concept or term? That's what you're trying to extract. It's not wordsmithing the perfect definition to consider on a fortune cookie, which, you know, a lot of committees I've been on end up trying to do. So I think it's your phrase, like exposing the meaning in actionable ways is closer.
So I would say that it's a challenge, right? I mean, the first thing is that each participant that comes to a standard development organization, they have in their head their own nascent standard, right? And they're just trying to convince everybody else that it should be that way. So ultimately, the standard is going to be morphed by all those different opinions. So it's very hard to try and create something that is of structure and still of meaningful value to the participants and the organizations that are driving that forward. In terms of the biometrics industry, as Elaine mentioned, you know, when I mentioned the API at the API level and I talked about the six functions, that in my mind, that was driving it from a conceptual model perspective. Right? As Elaine said, terms might not have been correct. And frankly, when things got mature and this moved into an ISO environment, there were different working groups established for different parts of the work, and it was actually the technical implementations that drove forward and had to move forward in the absence of terminology definition. But they had the concept. So they were working with the concepts that they understood, and they developed the standards around that. So I feel that there was a lot of efforts made at that time to try and really deal in, you know, conceptual model type work. But it didn't mean anything that made it easy for someone to come in and actually understand how this related to other standards. It just didn't. And I think the unfortunate reality is that standards, because of the way they're driven and created, it's very hard. You can do a common structure, and there is, but not all the same definitions and concepts within each standard.
Terry Longstreth, I've worked on a lot of standards, but there are two on exactly almost completely opposite ends of the spectrum from a software perspective. One standard that I work with is the Open Archival Information System standard, which is an abstract standard that basically conceptualizes what this system looks like. What does the system look like? What are the major components? And that's about it. It says, well, you got these five things you have to do in ingestion, you have to process it, you have to preserve it, and you have to be able to get the stuff out at the end. That's one standard. I couldn't put an ontology together that would do that justice. But I don't need a whole lot because the words themselves are only intended to be used by people. Later on, we're going to have to do some much more detailed requirements about how real archival systems will work. Another thing I worked on, though, was the ISO 11179 metadata standard, metadata repository standard. That was very complicated, and really almost looks like an ontology under the covers. But it's still not really machine processable, and that's what Mark, you started out saying, it has to be machine processable. I don't know how you can do that.
Well, certainly in the current standards development process, there is a disconnect between the natural language that's used to write the standard and the information machines that are supposed to implement the standard. eventually be resolved, but it's definitely an issue right now.
Last time I'll chime in on the subject because I don't want to monopolize it. I write blogs, and I'm using as much of the schema.org process that I can to do that. The reason I do it is not ontological. It's because I want the blog to be spidered in Google search. This is a bottom-up way of moving toward an ontology, though. A lot of people can live with that. You can call it tagging. You know, there's lots of ways to look at it. Whether the tags are canonical across disciplines, whether the tags are originated by people who have ontologies that are mapped out and say you have to pick a tag out of this ontology for document indexing, you're still moving towards some kind of canonical structure and tagging, whatever terminology you want to use for that. And it enables Google search to look at it, enables the schema.org thing to look at it, enables Google's metadata display, because they have a tool that will display it in schema.org format, so I can see whether my blog post can be spidered by the three major search engines. So this is what I'm saying, is this is the kind of tool we want with the standards, so the participating agents can examine this document with these other tools, and yeah, they're quasi-ontological in nature. They're not what any of us would want to write code with, but just as is happening with schema.org, you're able to move incrementally toward it with some pretty useful tools that are automated. Well, SEO is an example of a collection of tools, though, that is both people and tooling. You know, we couldn't do that just by hand.
Yeah, but you couldn't use the tools. The ontology you've got isn't going to drive an inference engine.
Let's just say that the sophisticated agencies who will get paid to do SEO use tools to figure out what the tags ought to be. So it's a combination of people and automation.
Okay.
I have a question about the standards process. I've never been on a standards board, so I don't know the answer. When it's decided to create a standard, is there any effort put into defining the requirements that the standards are supposed to meet before people start trying to figure out what the standard is?
Yes and no. So typically you have a proposal stage in the beginning, and depending on the rigor of the committee that's meeting, they will look for requirements. If they don't get it from the beginning, but they decide to start a project up anyway, a lot of times you'll have a discussion about requirements.
There's always a scope at the, say, ISO IEC level, and that is a requirement that you have to meet, and you have to work within that, but there's a lot of flexibility there.
But to Mark's point, that if there was a requirement that whatever was produced would need to be machine readable or machine interpretable or something, might constrain or change the direction in which the process takes.
Certainly. And you could put that in the scope.
The gentleman in the green shirt, I see.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to make a comment that we've been through at in NIBS in a project some standards, and what we did was went to ISO for the style format and also the directives for actually establishing the format for the committee. So there are, and ANSI uses those as standards, so there are, depending on what type of standard you're developing, there are guides out there to give you information about how you would like to proceed.
Gary Burcross, I have a question in a slightly different direction. So we heard about the question, open question about what is the thing within IoT. We also heard about biometric ideas on identity. So is there work underway to essentially consider the identity of non-human things that we might be concerned about? Can we leverage the biometrical work as a subtype of this? That would help define things, and so, identity for things.
There is. I mean, I suspect it might have a little broader knowledge. I know that in the identity standards that are evolving, there certainly is a concept of non-person entities that is often considered. And there's lots of debates about whether that should be included into the standard about identity or not. So there are some, particularly within ISO, I think SC 27.
There's more than one standard between ITU-T. There's also an SC 31 project. I think there's an IEEE SC 31 joint project possibly. What's not clear is if any of these identity schemes meet requirements for an internet.
I can imagine lots of security issues on making sure that the resource you think is working on this particular thing in your home is the right resource and service, things of that nature.
And privacy, mobility, and any of those requirements.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the identity standards are really being established on the basis of an individual wants to make a claim for an entitlement, right? And there's a transaction occurring. It's a different model, really, from a non-person entity, right? So there's particularly the privacy considerations are different, the information flow that's required to invoke that transaction. So there is certainly a lot of people that say, you know, it could be in the same standard, but there's not better to be considered separately. It is pre-existing workload. I think that was the basis of the question.
Go ahead. Please.
No, thank you. I wanted to mention that within the ISO, there is work being done to develop registries. One of those areas which has been used on the internet already is the OID. That's going to be expanded now. SC31, which you mentioned, is involved in that, and WG10 is, I guess, going to take up some of this now also. But particularly the cargo shipping industry I mentioned earlier is just a huge area. I mean, it's just not like one standard. There's literally hundreds to be able to harmonize all those. And again, they referenced initially OID, but they recognize they've got to make it a much more extensive ontology, if you will. Thanks.
So I'll just mention that WG10 wouldn't be working on that standardization directly, but may provide requirements driven by the architecture and to the process.
Right. Any other questions?
One more question that I had was the, you know, within the ISO, IEEE, obviously these are international bodies, and a lot of the people are from around the world. They don't speak English. So they have to interpret what we're trying to talk about here in ontologies using English wording. And the things that are being discussed are of the describing, like Eric said, the process is somewhat reversed at times, that probably moving away from the individual word definition might be helpful and have just a general description, which Eric just mentioned earlier. And then working back, this may be much more like a reiterative type process to do this. But in some ways, I guess what's coming to my mind, like we just had the cyber physical systems working group meeting, I guess that was last week. And Eric had some great input, by the way, on security. And, but the process was very good. There was a framework there set up. But it also made sense to do it in reverse, quite frankly. It actually revealed more at times by doing it. So possibly that reiterative process going back and forth, but yet not just coming up with the final word, if you will, that more like you were talking about earlier of descriptive definition, sounds like it's starting to make much more sense to me. Thanks.
Any other questions? Stop.
Yeah, I think, thank you.
I have one question.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Given that we have so many domains and so many pieces that are going to come together in IoT, are we doomed to build separate ontologies and find ways to integrate and map them? Is that the only way we're going to approach this problem? And what does it mean for standards?
Yes. Because there are so many domains, you can't have a single ontology for everything, and then you get into the ontology mapping. And in any case, in order to produce a single ontology, if that was even feasible, would take too bloody long. So you should expect that various versions of ontologies will pop up, be used, be trashed, and hopefully they'll be able to be evolved. Then the more important question becomes, how are they used?
Yes.
Are you building your systems to exploit the dynamism that ontologies can provide, or are you just building yourself into a corner as usual?
So we talked a little bit about this yesterday in terms of modular ontologies. So you have something like the semantic sensor network, which is a pattern, connects observation sensors, devices, but you don't necessarily have a detailed model of devices. You have multiple sensors on devices. So the ontology arc has a sort of a building block and can connect to other building blocks. We have more detail, and you can plug in your own building block. So one can imagine in different domains, different types of sensors are important, and you can plug that in. But then once you do that, you want to have something in terms of intelligence, you want to have something on top of that that understands some of those distinctions for the purposes you want to reason in. So you're going to have levels of ontology at different levels of abstraction. Some of them are very concrete, like sensors. Some of them are more socially oriented in terms of how entities work together, interact.
So you have to end up having mappings both going upwards and sideways.
Right.
Well, that brings up one of Leo's favorite topics, which is ontological architecture, which, of course, requires some modularity. And that's one thing, even if the standards bodies don't produce ontologies, they could start by addressing the ontological architecture. For instance, in the case of XMNT, you showed us all those various extensions. Well, XMNTPC should probably have addressed how those ontologies might fit together, i.e. the architecture thereof.
Thank you very much. Again, thank the panel.
Thank you.
So that also gives a segue into discussions for the rest of the day in terms of the ontological architecture start. Well, anyway, that's for, I think one of the things that we do at the end of the session here, Michael, a couple of things that we need to wrap up right now. One is I hope everyone has signed the communique.
Right. Has anyone not signed the affirmation of the communique? Yeah, there was some on the chat, right. But for people who are physical objects here, unless they have an internet pen that can write, then okay, everyone here? Okay. So, yeah, and also there were the ones that were in the chat, and also people can email your affirmation to the Ontology Summit.
So what's come on, I think this is Michael.
Oh,
it's a general chair, you know, it's
okay.
What do we
use that?
Use here.
I want
okay, so yeah, just the concluding comments, because we were scheduled to wrap up around 4. But just before we kind of get to those comments, just want to take time to thank all the people that helped us get here today. We want to save that for the end, and we're all rushing out. So I'd like to thank Fouad and everyone else at the NCO NITRED offices and all the tech support for helping get everything set up here in the room. I'd like to thank Rom and Leo, especially Rom for all of his Costco trips, for keeping us caffeinated and breakfast in the morning. yes, and also Joe Capena for putting together our summit and symposium webpage and everything. That was a great step up, a newbie to the organization of the Ontology Summit, so grateful to Joe.
I took a number of photographs, and this will be on the web page unless someone has some serious objections. That's what
Peter
does every
year.
Your objection to the photographs. Okay, so all photographs are removed.
And also just like to thank all the keynote speakers. Rom for organizing all the fantastic series of keynote speakers. And thanks, Sub, and all today's panelists for some interesting presentations and ideas for IoT standards. There's a lot of material that we've covered over the past 3 months, and a lot of interesting syntheses and new material that has been presented over the past day and today with the symposium. So there's a lot to kind of be thinking about. So some people have asked also, like, where does this go from here? So as we said this morning when we were talking about the presentation of the communique will be roughly in the same form as it is right now. We'll be adding the references, People have identified a few typos and some formatting, things like that. But more or less, the communique will be in that state, and that's what will be appearing on the symposium and summit website. But there will be two future incarnations of the communique as papers in the Journal of Applied Ontology and in the IEEE Journal for Internet of Things. And we'll be people who were the editors for the communique and also any other people who are interested. We'll be trying to maybe do some coordination as to the final drafting of those papers, because there'll be a little bit of extensions in order to address the kind of the needs, the specific needs of the communities that we're submitting those two versions of the paper to. I think we haven't really thought of too many other concrete mechanisms. Before I get to that, though, but concrete mechanisms for continuing on the discussions of this symposium. In previous years, it's gone in a lot of different directions. The year we had the Educating the Ontologist of the Future, we actually had a workshop at a conference the following year for the Ontology Repositories Summit that we had in 2000X, that actually led to an Open Ontology Repository Initiative. That's led to the development of and use of two widespread ontology repositories. So there have been different mechanisms for continuing on the work of a particular summit. We haven't really done too much about that, but there will be a virtual session, sometime in May. We haven't pinned down the date yet, but this is what we call the post-mortem session for the summit, where we discuss like concrete physical things, how to improve things for the following years, but also ways to continue on. So people can be in between now and when that session is announced on the Ontology Summit and the Ontolog invitation list to think about other ways that we can continue the discussions we've had and the resources we've acquired. Joe, do you have a question? Or?
Yes, this is Joe Cabina. And actually, stepping back just a moment to the articles for the journals, I was wondering if there would be other people interested in potentially coordinating a couple of articles about specific technical work related to go with Summit Communique, and then potentially approach them about an issue with those.
Yeah, I mean, that might be something we can explore, like, say, when we have the postmortem session. So
yeah, I don't know how feasible that is or anything, right. If there's enough interest or if there's interest on their side, but
right.
It's just a thought.
Yeah, and I think that's something we'll want to have that kind of follow-up discussion in May. At the virtual session we have in May to again kind of make more concrete proposals for these next steps, because we don't want the summit to just simply end in 20 minutes and gather cyber dust, but actually to have some concrete follow-ups. And so we'll want to discuss ways of continuing the discussions and efforts and all following the recommendations that we had in the communique of having more coordinated efforts of gathering use cases, more coordinated efforts of evaluating the ontologies that people are providing for IoT, IoT standards. I think it's that kind of coordination that can really come out of a lot of efforts like this.
What's the rough time frame people are thinking for those articles?
So traditionally, it's within the next, it'd be like by the end of the summer, I guess. Who else has done this before? Yeah, something like that. Right. Yeah. For the Applied Ontology Journal, we want to get that sooner than later. So I'm not sure. Mark, did you have any internal deadlines for the IEEE Journal? No, he's shaking his head.
Yeah. Sorry. I believe there's a quarterly review there, so it's really just constraints of the authoring process here. I don't see it happening in the next 30 days, but probably within the next 90.
Yeah.
Mike? Yeah. Do you have a notion of what you want to include in the IEEE article other than what's currently in the communique? First question.
So Mark, I guess in the informal division of labor, Mark's going to be spearheading the IEEE paper, and I'll be shepherding the applied ontology paper. Are there any other points kind of raised up on this? And like I say, well, we can have these follow-up discussions at the May postmortem session.
Well, I'd like to bring up something, Michael. It's the efforts that you put in over the last how many months to take care of all these nitty little details that can screw things up royally. And I know you've been doing it by yourself, so I want to thank you, and I feel guilty because I wasn't able to provide any aid this year. So please thank you, Michael.
And I would nominate Michael for the Peter Yin Award this year.
But I also would like to, on that note, though, I would also like to thank Peter Yim and Ken Kapowski, who actually were the ones that were doing the uploading. So we kind of had a relay race here where somebody would pass the file on to me, and I'd pass the baton on to Ken and Peter, and they would actually be the ones to put that up there. That's definitely a process we need to streamline. But thanks to Peter and Ken for actually getting these documents on the session page. So that's a shout-out to them as well. Oh, okay. Go ahead, Leo. Oh, I think he's okay.
Do you have a comment?
Oh, yeah. I was actually typing it in. Sorry. I still will. But I just wanted to say that you need to build in some time for example, the Applied Ontology Journal and probably the IEEE, because a couple of us, like Ram and I, for example, have to put these through a public release process. Which takes a little bit of time. So if we have a version of it and then there's comments and so forth to fix whatever the issues are, we do have to get approval from our companies or the government.
In the past, hasn't it taken about 1 month or less, Leo?
Yeah, it doesn't have to take long. In some cases, I push it through very quickly by, facilitating it myself directly and cutting through the bureaucracy. But I don't know about Ram, whether he's got comparable issues.
Yeah, Ram also says about a month. Yeah.
So anyways, you just factor that in. So, like, in the past, we've typically had, a round of maybe reviews among the organizing committee and maybe others if they want, just to, even though we don't want to change the communique, just to get other people to look at it. And so that may take, a month or so. It's varied in the past. Like last year, we got it done, I think, sometime in August. So, in general, you want to get it done as early as you can.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thanks, Neil. Mark, did you have any final thoughts? So, as Ron was just mentioning before as well, so that kind of was all the issues related to this year's summit, but also one thing that often happens at these summits. So, this is we've had the summits annually since 2006, every year being a different topic and theme about ontologies, ontological analysis, ontology applications. And so one of the things people often do is ask, well, hey, what will be happening next year? And so one thing is that this is also something that gets discussed, say, at this postmortem session in May. But one thing that has been, there have been a few discussions over beers and coffee about one, perhaps maybe slightly innovative style for next year's summit would be, given that we've been having these summits since 2006, so over the past 10 years, it's our 11th or 10th? 11th?
This is the 10th summit.
It's the 10th. So one of the ideas that's been percolating is for next year, rather than having a specific topic, to actually have a format where we have a series or a set of challenge problems. And so the metaphor I was using was, if you do the survival training, you get dropped off in the middle of the forest, and you have to use all of your skills in order to get back home. The idea would be that we have, over the next four months, I guess, start at gathering what would be possible challenge problems that we would address in the next year's summit. And these would be problems, like challenge problems, where you would need all of your ontological wits about you to actually solve that problem, or at least address that problem. And so what we can maybe be thinking about, and again, this is something we'd be discussing at the May postmortem session, but what could these challenge problems be? And so rather than having tracks, we had like four tracks this year, to have four or five challenge problems, and what everyone's work would be doing would be addressing one or more of those challenge problems. And it could be the nature of a team that's, you know, actually building an ontology-based solution. It could be somebody who's building ontologies that could be applied to these challenge problems. It could be people proposing tools that can help apply ontology to that problem. So we're kind of wide open here. But this would be sort of this novel idea. And this can be something people think about. But, we'll talk more about it in May. But just a little, I'm going to want to plant that seed.
Yeah, I have a comment on that, Michael, because we have this, I think many of you are familiar with this Smart Cities Challenge that NIST puts forward. I think it's putting forward right now, where people take these kinds of challenges and come together and present the demos and things like that. And what are the things, gaps that they have faced and how to overcome and things like that. And maybe it'll be good to look at that. They think they have, before that they have Smart America, Smart America, Smart Cities. Now they have these challenges.
Right.
So maybe we can have Smart Ontology Challenge.
Right. Right. And so the idea was, because some people had also mentioned that maybe a retrospective, given that this was our 10th Ontology Summit, having a retrospective. But rather than having a kind of a nostalgic retrospective, you have something that all of the lessons we've learned over the past 10 years are the lessons that we need to apply.
And reprocess them.
And reprocess them. And apply all these lessons we've learned and all the techniques and ideas and really apply them to solve some real concrete kinds of issues and challenges. So,
as one of the newest members of the community, I would love to throw a whole bunch of water and fertilizer on your seed. I think it's a great idea. I love challenge problems in communities like this with this level of expertise and homes thinking. It's a great idea.
Okay, great.
In some prior years, we've had as part of the summits, hackathons, right, 3, 4, or 5 groups. And so I can imagine that some people may, given a problem, also have incorporated as part of the rest, a little bit of a hackathon to show a very small version of what Joe showed us in terms
right.
of an application that comes out of any ontologies that are related to that.
Yeah. And so we're just, brainstorming at this point. And so you can have all kinds of forms. It can be the forms of demos or whatever. But, people can think about these and we'll have more discussions if we decide to have this kind of format. We'll have more discussions on how to fine-tune the format and expectations and things like that.
Yeah, and also Shamin Palit yesterday, one of the keynote speakers, he kind of volunteered the Industrial Internet Consortium for this.
So I don't know if there are any other things that people want to discuss. We have a time. Anybody online? I'm away from my screen. Okay.
Also, one of the things I'd like to point out is
I have a comment. If we can have some shared screen support, would be great.
Yes, and that's exactly what the one of the parts of the postmortem session will be all about is the technical improvements we can make in the delivery of the summit, both physically and virtually. I agree.
Thank you. And many, many thanks to everybody. Really, over the last 4 months, I saw the tempo build, and I hope it continues a little bit.
We'd like to specifically thank George Strong from NITRD for providing this room, the facilities, and volunteers. And George, I don't know where you are, but thank you. I appreciate your
Thank you, Ram, because George is really a mover, moving force.
Okay. All right. Well, then I declare the Ontology Summit Symposium 2015 officially closed.
Thanks, everybody, and bye.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.